What, he wondered, were ghosts supposed to do all night? He sat uneasily and...
Ничего!
Ничего не пишите!
Пишите!
Ничего не читайте!
Читайте!
Ничего не говорите!
Ничего не печатайте!
And watched the television. Soon, however, the car chases drifted peacefully to a close, and there was nothing left but grey snow and white noise, which he was unable to turn off. He found he'd sunk too far into the chair and confused himself with bits of it as he pushed and pulled himself up. He tried to amuse himself by standing in the middle of a table, but it did little to alleviate a mood that was sliding inexorably from despondency downwards. Perhaps he would sleep. Perhaps. He felt no tiredness or drowsiness, but just a deadly craving for oblivion. He passed back through the closed door and into the dark hallway, from which the wide, heavy stairs led to the large, gloomy bedrooms above. Up these, emptily, he trod. It was for nothing, he knew. If you cannot open the door to a bedroom, you cannot sleep in its bed. He slid himself through the door and lifted himself onto the bed, which he knew to be cold, though he could not feel it. The moon seemed unable to leave him alone and shone full on him as he lay there, wide-eyed and empty, unable now to remember what sleep was or how to do it. The horror of hollowness lay on him, the horror of lying ceaselessly and forever awake at 4 o'clock in the morning. He had nowhere to go, nothing to do when he got there, and no one he could go and wake up who wouldn't be utterly horrified to see him. The worst moment had been when he had seen Richard on the road, Richard's face frozen white in the windscreen. He saw again his face and that of the pale figure next to him. That had been the thing which had shaken out of him the lingering shred of warmth at the back of his mind which said that this was just a temporary problem. It seemed terrible in the night hours, but would be all right in the morning when he could see people and sort things out. He fingered the memory of the moment in his mind and could not let it go. He had seen Richard. And Richard, he knew, had seen him. It was not going to be all right. Usually when he felt this bad at night, he popped downstairs to see what was in the fridge, so he went now. It would be more cheerful than this moonlit bedroom. He would hang around the kitchen, going bump in the night. He slid down and partially through the banisters, wafted through the kitchen door without a second thought, and then devoted all his concentration and energy for about 5 minutes to getting the light switch on. That gave him a real sense of achievement, and he determined to celebrate with a beer. After a moment or two of repeatedly juggling and dropping a can of Foster's, he gave it up. He had not the slightest conception of how he could manage to open a ring pull, and besides, the stuff was all shaken up by now, and what was he going to do with the stuff, even if he could get it open? He didn't have a body to keep it in. He hurled the can away from him, and it scuttled off under a cupboard. He began to notice something about himself, which was the way in which his ability to grasp things seemed to grow and fade in a slow rhythm, as did his visibility. There was an irregularity in the rhythm, though, or perhaps it was just that sometimes the effects of it would be much more pronounced than at others. That, too, seemed to vary according to a slower rhythm. Just at that moment it seemed to him that his strength was on the increase. In a sudden fever of activity, he tried to see how many things in the kitchen he could move or use or somehow get to work. He pulled open cupboards, yanked out drawers, scattering cutlery on the floor. He got a brief whir out of the food processor. He knocked over the electric coffee grinder without getting it to work. He turned on the gas on the cooker hob, but then couldn't light it. He savaged a loaf of bread with a carving knife. He tried stuffing lumps of bread into his mouth, but they simply fell through his mouth to the floor. A mouse appeared, but scurried from the room, its coat electric with fear. Eventually, he stopped and sat on the kitchen table, emotionally exhausted but physically numb. How, he wondered, would people react to his death? Who would be most sorry to know that he had gone? For a while, there would be shock, then sadness. Then they would adjust, and he would be a fading memory as people got on with their own lives without him, thinking that he had gone on to wherever people go. That was a thought that filled him with the most icy dread. He had not gone. He was still here. He sat facing one cupboard that he hadn't managed to open yet because its handle was too stiff, and that annoyed him. He grappled awkwardly with a tin of tomatoes and then went over again to the large cupboard and attacked the handle with the tin. The door flew open, and his own missing, blood-stained body fell horribly forward out of it. Gordon hadn't realized up to this point that it was possible for a ghost to faint. He realized it now and did it. He was woken a couple of hours later by the sound of his gas cooker exploding. Chapter 16. The following morning, Richard woke up twice. The first time, he assumed he'd made a mistake and turned over for a fitful few minutes more. The second time, he sat up with a jolt, as the events of the previous night insisted themselves upon him. He went downstairs and had a moody and unsettled breakfast, during which nothing went right. He burnt the toast, spilt the coffee, and realised that though he'd meant to buy some more marmalade yesterday, he hadn't. He surveyed his feeble attempt at feeding himself and thought that maybe he could at least allow himself the time to take Susan out for an amazing meal tonight to make up for last night, if he could persuade her to come. There was a restaurant that Gordon had been enthusing about at great length and recommending that they try. Gordon was pretty good on restaurants. He certainly seemed to spend enough time in them. He sat and tapped his teeth with a pencil for a couple of minutes, and then went up to his workroom and lugged a telephone directory out from under a pile of computer magazines. L'Esprit d'Escalier. He phoned the restaurant and tried to book a table, but when he said when he wanted it for, this seemed to cause a little amusement. Ah, non, monsieur, said the maitre d', I regret that it is impossible. At this moment it is necessary to make reservations at least 3 weeks in advance, pardon, monsieur. Richard marvelled at the idea that there were people who actually knew what they wanted to do 3 weeks in advance, thanked the maitre d' and rang off. Well, maybe a pizza again, instead. This thought connected back to the appointment he had failed to keep last night, and after a moment, curiosity overcame him, and he reached for the phone book again. Gentlemen, gentles, gentry. There was no gently at all, not a single one. He found the other directories, except for the Esther Z book, which his cleaning lady continually threw away for reasons he had never yet fathomed. There was certainly no Chelly or anything like it. There was no gently with a J, no gently with a DG, no gently with a DJ, no gently with a DZ, nor anything remotely similar. He wondered about TJ Entley, TS Entley, or TZ Entley, and tried director inquiries, but they were out. He sat and tapped his teeth with the pencil again, and watched his sofa slowly revolving on the screen of his computer. How very peculiar it had been that it had only been hours earlier that Reg had asked after Dirk with such urgency. If you really wanted to find someone, how would you set about it and what would you do? He tried phoning the police, but they were out too. Well, that was that. He had done all he could do for the moment short of hiring a private detective, and he had better ways of wasting his time and money. He would run into Dirk again, as he did every few years or so. He found it hard to believe that there were really such people, anyway, as private detectives. What sort of people were they? What did they look like? Where did they work? What sort of tie would you wear if you were a private detective? Presumably it would have to be exactly the sort of tie that people wouldn't expect private detectives to wear. Imagine having to sort out a problem like that when you'd just got up. Just out of curiosity as much as anything else, and because the only alternative was settling down to anthem coding, he found himself leafing through the yellow pages. Private detectives. See detective agencies. The words looked almost odd in such a solid and business-like context. He flipped back through the book. Dry cleaners, dog breeders, dental technicians, detective agencies. At that moment the phone rang and he answered it, a little curtly. He didn't like being interrupted. Something wrong, Richard? Oh, hi, Kate. Sorry, no, I was... my mind was elsewhere. Kate Anselm was another star programmer at WayForward Technologies. She was working on a long-term artificial intelligence project, the sort of thing that sounded like an absurd pipe dream until you heard her talking about it. Gordon needed to hear her talking about it quite regularly, partly because he was nervous about the money it was costing, and partly because, well, there was little doubt that Gordon liked to hear Kate talking anyway. I didn't want to disturb you, she said. It's just I was trying to contact Gordon and can't. There's no reply from London, or the cottage, or his car, or his bleeper. It's just that for someone as obsessively in contact as Gordon, it's a bit odd. You heard he's had a phone put in his isolation tank, true. I haven't spoken to him since yesterday, said Richard. He suddenly remembered the tape he had taken from Susan's answering machine, and hoped to God there wasn't anything more important in Gordon's message than ravings about rabbits. He said, I know he was going to the cottage. I don't know where he is. Have you tried? Richard couldn't even think of anywhere else to try. Good God. Richard? How extraordinary. Richard, what's the matter? Nothing, Kate. Just read the most astounding thing. Really? What are you reading? Well, the telephone directory, in fact. Really? I must rush out and buy one. Have the film rights gone? Look, sorry, Kate, can I get back to you? I don't know where Gordon is at the moment, and don't worry, I know how it is when you can't wait to turn the next page. They always keep you guessing till the end, don't they? It must have been Zbigniew that did it. Have a good weekend. She hung up. Richard hung up too, and sat staring at the box advertisement lying open in front of him in the yellow pages. It said, Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency. We solve the whole crime. We find the whole person. Phone today for the whole solution to your problem. Missing cats and messy divorces, a speciality. 33A Peckender Street, London, N1. 01-354-9112. Peckender Street was only a few minutes walk away. Richard scribbled down the address, pulled on his coat, and trotted downstairs, stopping to make another quick inspection of the sofa. There must, he thought, be something terribly obvious that he was overlooking. The sofa was jammed on a slight turn in the long, narrow stairway. At this point, the stairs were interrupted for a couple of yards of flat landing, which corresponded with the position of the flat directly beneath Richard's. However, his inspection produced no new insights, and he eventually clambered on over it and out of the front door. In Islington, you can hardly hurl a brick without hitting three antique shops, an estate agent, and a bookshop. Even if you didn't actually hit them, you would certainly set off their burglar alarms, which wouldn't be turned off again till after the weekend. A police car played its regular game of dodgems down Upper Street and squealed to a halt just past him. Richard crossed the road behind it. The day was cold and bright, which he liked. He walked across the top of Islington Green, where Winers got beaten up, past the site of the old Collins Music Hall, which had got burnt down, and through Camden Passage, where American tourists get ripped off. He browsed among the antiques for a while and looked at a pair of earrings which he thought Susan would like, but he wasn't sure. Then he wasn't sure that he liked them, got confused, and gave up. He looked in at a bookshop and, on an impulse, bought an anthology of Coleridge's poems, since it was just lying there. From here, he threaded his way through the winding back streets, over the canal, past the council estates that lined the canal, through a number of smaller and smaller squares, till finally he reached Peckender Street, which had turned out to be a good deal further than he thought. It was the sort of street where property developers in large Jaguars drive around at the weekend salivating. It was full of end-of-lease shops, Victorian industrial architecture, and a short decaying late Georgian terrace, all just itching to be pulled down so that sturdy young concrete boxes could sprout in their places. Estate agents roamed the area in hungry packs, eyeing each other warily, their clipboards on a hair trigger. Number 33, when he eventually found it, neatly sandwiched between 37 and 45, was in a poorish state of repair, but no worse than most of the rest. The ground floor was a dusty travel agent's whose window was cracked and whose faded BOAC posters were probably now quite valuable. The doorway next to the shop had been painted bright red, not well, but at least recently. A push button next to the door said, in neatly penciled lettering, Dominique, French lessons, troisième floor. The most striking feature of the door, however, was the bold and shiny brass plaque fixed in the dead centre of it, on which was engraved the legend, Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency. Nothing else. It looked brand new. Even the screws that held it in place were still shiny. The door opened to Richard's push, and he peered inside. He saw a short and musty hallway, which contained little but the stairway that led up from it. A door at the back of the hall showed little sign of having been opened in recent years, and had stacks of old metal shelving, a fish tank, and the carcass of a bike piled up against it. Everything else, the walls, the floor, the stairs themselves, and as much of the rear door as could be got at, had been painted grey in an attempt to smarten it up cheaply. But it was now all badly scuffed, and little cups of fungus were peeking from a damp stain near the ceiling. The sounds of angry voices reached him, and as he started up the stairs, he was able to disentangle the noise of two entirely separate but heated arguments that were going on somewhere above him. One ended abruptly, or at least half of it did, as an angry, overweight man came clattering down the stairs, pulling his raincoat collar straight. The other half of the argument continued in a torrent of aggrieved French from high above them. The man pushed past Richard and said, "Save your money, mate, it's a complete washout," and disappeared out into the chilly morning. The other argument was more muffled. As Richard reached the first corridor, a door slammed somewhere and brought that too to an end. He looked into the nearest open doorway. It led into a small ante-office. The other inner door leading from it was firmly closed. A youngish, plump-faced girl in a cheap blue coat was pulling sticks of makeup and boxes of Kleenex out of her desk drawer and thrusting them into her bag. "Is this the detective agency?" Richard asked her tentatively. The girl nodded, biting her lip and keeping her head down. "And is Mr. Gently in?" "He may be," she said, throwing back her hair, which was too curly for throwing back properly. "And then again, he may not be. I am not in a position to tell. It is not my business to know of his whereabouts. His whereabouts are, as of now, entirely his own business." She retrieved her last pot of nail varnish and tried to slam the drawer shut. A fat book sitting upright in the drawer prevented it from closing. She tried to slam the door again without success. She picked up the book, ripped out a clump of pages, and replaced it. This time, she was able to slam the drawer with ease. "Are you his secretary?" asked Richard. "I am his ex-secretary, and I intend to stay that way," she said, firmly snapping her bag shut. "If he intends to spend his money on stupid expensive brass plaques rather than on paying me, then let him. But I won't stay to stand for it, thank you very much. Good for business, my foot. Answering the phones properly is good for business, and I'd like to see his fancy brass plaque do that. If you'll excuse me, I'd like to storm out, please." Richard stood aside, and out she stormed. "And good riddance!" shouted a voice from the inner office. A phone rang and was picked up immediately. "Yes?" answered the voice from the inner office testily. The girl popped back for her scarf, but quietly so her ex-employer wouldn't hear. Then she was finally gone. "Yes, Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency. How can we be of help to you?" The torrent of French from upstairs had ceased. A kind of tense calm descended. Inside, the voice said, "That's right, Mrs. Sunderland. Messy divorces are our particular speciality." There was a pause. "Yes, thank you, Mrs. Sunderland. Not quite that messy." Down went the phone again, to be replaced instantly by the ringing of another one. Richard looked around the grim little office. There was very little in it. A battered chipboard veneer desk, an old grey filing cabinet, and a dark green tin waste paper bin. On the wall was a Duran Duran poster, on which someone had scrawled in fat red felt tip, "Take this down, please." Beneath that, another hand had scrawled, "No." Beneath that again, the first hand had written, "I insist that you take it down." Beneath that, the second hand had written, "Won't." Beneath that, "You're fired." Beneath that, "Good." And there the matter appeared to have rested. He knocked on the inner door, but was not answered. Instead, the voice continued, "I'm very glad you asked me that, Mrs. Rawlinson. The term holistic refers to my conviction that what we are concerned with here is the fundamental interconnectedness of all things. I do not concern myself with such petty things as fingerprint powder, telltale pieces of pocket fluff, and inane footprints. I see the solution to each problem as being detectable in the pattern and web of the whole. The connections between causes and effects are often much more subtle and complex than we, with our rough and ready understanding of the physical world, might naturally suppose, Mrs. Rawlinson. Let me give you an example. If you go to an acupuncturist with toothache, he sticks a needle instead into your thigh. Do you know why he does that, Mrs. Rawlinson?" "No, neither do I, Mrs. Rawlinson, but we intend to find out. A pleasure talking to you, Mrs. Rawlinson. Goodbye." Another phone was ringing as he put this down. Richard eased the door open and looked in. It was the same Svlad, or Dirk, Celi. Looking a little rounder about the middle, a little looser and redder about the eyes and the neck, but it was still essentially the same face that he remembered most vividly, smiling a grim smile as its owner climbed into the back of one of the Black Marias of the Cambridgeshire Constabulary 8 years previously. He wore a heavy old light brown suit, which looked as if it had been worn extensively for bramble-hacking expeditions in some distant and better past. A red checked shirt, which failed entirely to harmonise with the suit, and a green striped tie, which refused to speak to either of them. He also wore thick metal-rimmed spectacles, which probably counted at least in part for his dress sense. "Ah, Mrs. Bluthal, how thoroughly uplifting to hear from you," he was saying. "I was so distressed to hear that Miss Tiddles has passed over. This is desperate news indeed. And yet, should we allow black despair to hide from us the fairy light in which your blessed Moggy now forever dwells? I think not. Hark, I think I hear Miss Tiddles meowing e'en now. She calls to you, Mrs. Bluthal. She says she is content. She is at peace. She says she will be even more at peace when you've paid some bill or other. Does that ring a bell with you at all, Mrs. Bluthal? Come to think of it, I think I sent you one myself, not 3 months ago. I wonder if it can be that which is disturbing her eternal rest." Dirk beckoned Richard in with a brisk wave and then motioned him to pass the crumpled pack of French cigarettes that was sitting just out of his reach. "Sunday night, then, Mrs. Bluthal, Sunday night at 8:30. You know the address? Yes, I'm sure Miss Tiddles will appear, as I'm sure will your checkbook. Till then, Mrs. Bluthal, till then." Another phone was already ringing as he got rid of Mrs. Bluthal. He grabbed at it, lighting his crumpled cigarette at the same time. "Ah, Mrs. Soskind," he said in answer to the caller. "My oldest and, may I say, most valued client. Good day to you, Mrs. Soskind. Good day. Sadly, no sign as yet of young Roderick, I'm afraid, but the search is intensifying as it moves into what I am confident are its closing stages, and I'm sanguine that within mere days from today's date we will have the young rascal permanently restored to your arms and mewing prettily. Ah, yes, the bill, I was wondering if you had received it." Dirk's crumpled cigarette turned out to be too crumpled to smoke, so he hooked the phone onto his shoulder and poked around in the packet for another, but it was empty. He rummaged on his desk for a piece of paper and a stub of pencil. and wrote a note, which he passed to Richard. Yes, Mrs. Sorskind, he assured the telephone, I am listening with the utmost attention. The note said, tell secretary, get Siggs. Yes, continued Dirk into the phone, but as I have endeavoured to explain to you, Mrs. Sorskind, over the 7 years of our acquaintance, I incline to the quantum mechanical view in this matter. My theory is that your cat is not lost, but that his waveform has temporarily collapsed and must be restored, Schrödinger, Planck, and so on. Richard wrote on the note, you haven't got secretary, and pushed it back. Dirk considered this for a while, then wrote, damn and blast on the paper, and pushed it to Richard again. I grant you, Mrs. Sorskind, continued Dirk blithely, that 19 years is, shall we say, a distinguished age for a cat to reach, yet can we allow ourselves to believe that a cat such as Roderick has not reached it? And should we now, in the autumn of his years, abandon him to his fate? This surely is the time that he most needs the support of our continuing investigations. This is the time that we should redouble our efforts, and with your permission, Mrs. Sorskind, that is what I intend to do. Imagine, Mrs. Sorskind, how you would face him if you had not done this simple thing for him. Richard fidgeted with the note, shrugged himself, and wrote, I'll get them on it, and passed it back once more. Dirk shook his head in admonition, then wrote, I couldn't possibly, that would be most kind. As soon as Richard had read this, Dirk took the note back and added, get money from secretary to it. Richard looked at the paper thoughtfully, took the pencil, and put a tick next to where he had previously written, you haven't got secretary. He pushed the paper back across the table to Dirk, who merely glanced at it and ticked, I couldn't possibly, that would be most kind. Well, perhaps, continued Dirk to Mrs. Sorskind, you could just run over any of the areas in the bill that cause you difficulty, just the broader areas. Richard let himself out. Running down the stairs, he passed a young hopeful in a denim jacket and close-cropped hair, peering anxiously up the stairwell. Hey, any good, mate? He said to Richard. Amazing, murmured Richard, just amazing. He found a nearby newsagent's and picked up a couple of packets of Dies Blur for Dirk and a copy of the new edition of Personal Computer World, which had a picture of Gordon Way on the front. Oh, pity about him, isn't it? Said the newsagent. What? Yes, said Richard. He often thought the same himself, but was surprised to find his feelings so widely echoed. He picked up a Guardian as well, paid and left. Dirk was still on the phone, with his feet on the table, when Richard returned, and it was clear that he was relaxing into his negotiations. Yes, expenses were, well, expensive in the Bahamas, Mrs. Sorskind. It is in the nature of expenses to be so, hence the name. He took the proffered packets of cigarettes, seemed disappointed there were only two, but briefly raised his eyebrows to Richard in acknowledgement of the favour he had done him, then waved him to a chair. The sounds of an argument conducted partly in French drifted down from the floor above. Of course I will explain to you again why the trip to the Bahamas was so vitally necessary, said Dirk gently, soothingly. Nothing could give me greater pleasure. I believe, as you know, Mrs. Sorskind, in the fundamental interconnectedness of all things. Furthermore, I have plotted and triangulated the vectors of the interconnectedness of all things and traced them to a beach in the Bahamas, which it is therefore necessary for me to visit from time to time in the course of my investigations. I wish it were not the case, and sadly, I am allergic to both sun and rum punches, but then we all have our crosses to bear, do we not, Mrs. Sorskind? A babble seemed to break out from the phone. You sadden me, Mrs. Sorskind. I wish I could find it in my heart to tell you that I find your scepticism rewarding and invigorating, but with the best will in the world, I cannot. I am drained by it, Mrs. Sorskind, drained. I think you will find an item in the bill to the effect. Let me see. He picked up a flimsy carbon copy lying near him. Detecting and triangulating the vectors of interconnectedness of all things, £150, we've dealt with that. Tracing same to beach in Bahamas, fare and accommodation, a mere £1,500. The accommodation was, of course, distressingly modest. Ah, yes, here we are, struggling on in the face of draining scepticism from client. Drinks, £327.50. Would that I did not have to make such charges, my dear Mrs. Sorskind. Would that the occasion did not continually arise. Not believing in my methods only makes my job more difficult, Mrs. Sorskind, and hence, regrettably, more expensive. Upstairs, the sounds of argument were becoming more heated by the moment. The French voice seemed to be verging on hysteria. I do appreciate, Mrs. Sorskind, continued Dirk, that the cost of the investigation has strayed somewhat from the original estimate, but I'm sure you will in your turn appreciate that a job which takes 7 years to do must clearly be more difficult than one that can be pulled off in an afternoon, and must therefore be charged at a higher rate. I have continually to revise my estimate of how difficult the task is, in the light of how difficult it has so far proved to be. The babble from the phone became more frantic. My dear Mrs. Sorskind, or may I call you Joyce? Very well, then, my dear Mrs. Sorskind, let me say this. Do not worry yourself about the bill. Do not let it alarm or discomfort you. Do not, I beg you, let it become a source of anxiety to you. Just grit your teeth and pay it. He pulled his feet down off the table and leaned forward over the desk, inching the telephone receiver inexorably back towards its cradle. As always, the very greatest pleasure to speak with you, Mrs. Sorskind. For now, goodbye. He at last put down the receiver, picked it up again, and dropped it for the moment into the wastepaper basket. My dear Richard Macduff, he said, producing a large flat box from under his desk and pushing it across the table at him, your pizza. Richard stared back in astonishment. No thanks, he said. I had breakfast. Please, you have it. Dirk shrugged. I told them you'd pop in and settle up over the weekend, he said. Welcome, by the way, to my offices. He waved a vague hand around the tatty surroundings. The light works, he said, indicating the window. The gravity works, he said, dropping a pencil on the floor. Anything else we have to take our chances with. Richard cleared his throat. What, he said, is this? What is what? This, exclaimed Richard, all this, you appear to have a holistic detective agency, and I don't even know what one is. I provide a service that is unique in the world, said Dirk. The term holistic refers to my conviction that what we are concerned with here is the fundamental interconnectedness of... Yes, I got that bit earlier, said Richard. I have to say that it sounded a bit like an excuse for exploiting gullible old ladies. Exploiting? Asked Dirk. Well, I suppose it would be if anybody ever paid me, but I do assure you, my dear Richard, that there never seems to be the remotest danger of that. I live in what are known as hopes. I hope for fascinating and remunerative cases. My secretary hopes that I will pay her. Her landlord hopes that she will produce some rent. The electricity board hopes that he will settle their bill, and so on. I find it a wonderfully optimistic way of life. Meanwhile, I give a lot of charming and silly old ladies something to be happily cross about and virtually guarantee the freedom of their cats. Is there, you ask, and I put the question for you, because I know you know I hate to be interrupted, is there a single case that exercises the tiniest part of my intellect, which, as you hardly need me to tell you, is prodigious? No. But do I despair? Am I downcast? Yes. Until, he added, today. Oh, well, I'm glad of that, said Richard. But what was all that rubbish about cats and quantum mechanics? With a sigh, Dirk flipped open the lid of the pizza with a single flick of practiced fingers. He surveyed the cold round thing with a kind of sadness, and then tore off a hunk of it. Pieces of pepperoni and anchovy scattered over his desk. I am sure, Richard, he said, that you are familiar with the notion of Schrödinger's cat, and he stuffed the larger part of the hunk into his mouth. Of course, said Richard, well, reasonably familiar. What is it? Said Dirk, through a mouthful. Richard shifted in his seat. It's an illustration, he said, of the principle that at a quantum level all events are governed by probabilities. At a quantum level, and therefore at all levels, interrupted Dirk, though at any level higher than the subatomic, the cumulative effect of those probabilities is, in the normal course of events, indistinguishable from the effect of hard and fast physical laws. Continue. He put some more cold pizza into his face. Richard reflected that Dirk's was a face into which too much had already been put. What with that and the amount he talked, the traffic through his mouth was almost incessant. His ears, on the other hand, remained almost totally unused in normal conversation. It occurred to Richard that if Lamarck had been right, and you were to take a line through this behaviour for several generations, the chances were that some radical replumbing of the interior of the skull would eventually take place. Richard continued, Not only are quantum-level events governed by probabilities, but those probabilities aren't even resolved into actual events until they're measured, or to use a phrase I just heard you use in a rather bizarre context, the act of measurement collapses the probability waveform. Up until that point, all the possible courses of action open to, say, an electron coexist as probability waveforms. Nothing is decided until it's measured. Dirk nodded. More or less, he said, taking another mouthful. But what of the cat? Thank you.
The name Kathmandu conjures up a variety of romantic images. Many people will picture the city as some kind of mystical Shangri-La, perched high up in the clouds amid the peaks of the high Himalayas. Perhaps their impressions have been shaped by an old music hall poem from 100 years ago that tells the tale of a one-eyed yellow idol that lives to the north of this city in Nepal. This little idol is also mentioned by John Lennon in his song Nobody Told Me. So it lives on. But like that idea of Shangri-La, is it purely fiction or is it based on fact? Joanna Jolly has been trying to find out.
There's a one-eyed yellow idol to the north of Kathmandu. There's a little marble cross below the town. And a broken-hearted woman tends the grave of Mad Karu while the yellow god forever gazes down. And so begins the 1911 music hall poem, written by J. Milton Hayes, a tale of love, theft and tragedy in the Himalayas. I first heard it shortly before I moved to Kathmandu. My mother's friend Annie performed it at her 80th birthday party. She told me how her mother had recited it on long cold nights in Glasgow to provide entertainment before the age of television. The poem tells a tale of a young, wild British officer, Mad Karu, who's stationed in Kathmandu. One night, to impress the colonel's daughter, he steals the green eye of a little yellow idol. He returns badly injured, but the colonel's daughter refuses to accept the jewel. Later that night, the idol takes its revenge, and Mad Karu is found with a knife in his chest. He's buried in a grave near the idol, and the colonel's daughter, insane with grief, tends to it for the rest of her life. Annie asked if I would find out whether there was any truth to this tale. I promised to investigate, but with the distractions of setting up life in Kathmandu, the poem soon faded from my mind. That was until I met the flamboyant character of Dubby Bhagat. Dubby was originally from India, the son of a military general, and he'd had the sort of upbringing which meant he spoke perfectly enunciated Queen's English. He'd moved to Nepal in the 1970s, to pursue an eventful career as a journalist and restaurant owner. "My dear," he told me one night over dinner, "the little yellow idol does exist. I've seen it myself." Dubby told me how he'd tracked down the idol to a village north of Kathmandu, Sanku. So one morning, under a sky heavy with rain clouds, I hailed a taxi and set out on my quest. That day I was lucky to find the helpful Sangam Waiba, who took my pilgrimage very seriously. We drove out of the city, negotiating our way through grinding traffic and over potholed roads, until the concrete houses faded into paddy fields and swollen brown rivers. We passed piles of rotting rubbish, butted up against ancient moss-covered temples, and finally we reached Sanku itself. The town had been an important trading post for the Newar tribe that had ruled Kathmandu for centuries. The elaborate stone facades in the town centre spoke of a richer, more confident era. The road stopped at the bottom of a steep hill. "This temple is really in the jungle," observed Sangam, looking up at the steps that disappeared into the foliage above us. This was a good sign. The poem describes how the yellow god forever gazes down, so it made sense that he would sit at the top of a hill. We climbed up, passing by stone carvings of lions and eagles, until we reached a cluster of temples at the top. A gang of priests sat outside, playing cards noisily. They pointed us towards a building above them, and there, inside a soot-blackened room and behind a metal grill, sat a little yellow god. I was pleased to have found him so easily, but was he the real deal? He was gold-plated and sat on a podium, draped in red and gold silk, with offerings of flowers at his feet. He was about 3 foot tall and had a large tummy. From behind the grill, it was difficult to make out his eyes, but he had a stern expression on his face. A Nepali woman entered, and I asked her what she knew about the god in the cage. "He's actually a goddess," she told me. "It's the tantric goddess, Bajrajogini, who's worshipped by both Hindus and Buddhists." I asked her about the eyes. "You can't see them at the moment," she said. "We only put her eyes in during festivals. Then we give her eyes made of silver. We carry her down to the town and people pray to her. She's very powerful. She can grant you marriage and children." So was this the little yellow god who wreaked such dreadful vengeance on Mad Karu? And if so, Where was the one remaining green eye? The woman didn't know. Sangam and I left the temple and wandered back down the steps. On the way down, we asked the card-playing priests if they knew how old the goddess was. As old as creation, came the reply. As we walked back to the car, I wondered if there was a marble cross marking the grave of a British officer hidden somewhere among the stone carvings and jungle vines, and whether it had ever been tended to by a broken-hearted woman under the constant gaze of the little yellow god.
One minute. 1 minute beklemeni Sen istersen de gelmemeyi bilirsin ya Benim aşkım bana tatlı yapmış ama Geleceğim yanına az kaldı sıkı dur Sen neredeysen ben oradayım Bak biliyorum aklındayım Acele etme biraz sabret Geliyorum 1 minute Sen neredeysen ben oradayım Bak biliyorum aklındayım Acele etme biraz sabret Geliyorum 1 minute Kalbin duysun bu sesimi Sana olan sevgimi 1 minute Dedim ama bir lahzada gelebilirim Kalbin duysun bu sesimi Sana olan sevgimi 1 minute Dedim ama bir lahzada gelebilirim Sen neredeysen ben oradayım Bak biliyorum aklındayım Acele etme biraz sabret Geliyorum 1 minute Sen neredeysen ben oradayım Bak biliyorum aklındayım Acele etme biraz sabret Geliyorum 1 minute Sen neredeysen ben oradayım Bak biliyorum aklındayım Acele etme biraz sabret Geliyorum 1 minute Sen neredeysen ben oradayım Biliyorum aklındayım acele etme biraz sabret geliyorum 1 minute 1 minute 1 minute 1 minute 1 minute
flies away now, turns a moon. Time has no existence, it don't say you. In essence, we only, we do the time. This presence is our existence, we are the crime. The crime, the crime.